70. It's been a couple of weeks of mixed blessings for Michigan State University. U.S. News and World Report has named MSU's Medical School as one of the top schools in the country for primary care. That's a page one story this morning on the Lansing State Journal. But so is the report that an athletic booster has been asked to distance himself from the program because of some suspected improprieties. In addition, several athletes and one coach are facing serious legal problems. This afternoon, we're talking about Michigan State University, some of the problems that MSU has faced in recent weeks, some of the larger issues involved in athletics and academics, seminars that have been held, classes that have been added, because there's a story in the state news this morning about a new course on gays and lesbians that I wanted to talk about if we have time. We are talking this afternoon with MSU President John DiBiagio at 355-WKAR or 1-800-888-WKAR. Good to have you back.
Nice to be back, Carrie.
You pick up the paper this morning, and it's good news, bad news again, right?
Well, unfortunately, I think the bad news gets entirely too much focus. I suppose people are interested in reading about issues of critical nature, and I think those should be published. But unfortunately, we don't get enough coverage on the good things that are happening. For instance, a week or two ago, we had a leadership lecture. That lecture is sponsored by an endowment provided by the class of 1985. It is for student leaders from across the campus, from various organizations. On that evening, we also recognize those students who have become a member or members of Who's Who. I said that evening, and I was quite correct, that there would be no story in the press about that evening. It certainly wouldn't be on the front page if there were a story. And yet these were the students, I think, who truly represented Michigan State, who truly were reflective of the conscientiousness and the dedication of our overall student body.
Now, how would you answer those who would say, though, that you would expect at a university like MSU for students to be recognized for those kinds of qualities, for students to be recognized for being named a Who's Who, and that when a student is accused of or suspected of doing something either morally or legally wrong, that is unexpected, that is news?
Well, no. That quite the contrary. It is to be expected because we have 43,000 students on the university campus. We have 8,500 employees, a population in excess of 50,000. In a group of 50,000, in any aspect of society, you're bound to have a few individuals who are guilty of indiscretions. And why do those indiscretions, therefore, get all the focus if that would occur in any population, and they wouldn't get that kind of focus if they happened in other environments, just because they happen in a university? The university's purposes are primarily academic, and the focus, therefore, should be on academic matters and academic achievement and not on things that normally occur in society with any substantial group of people.
There was an editorial in the Lansing State Journal over the last week or so, in conjunction with news coverage of some of the arrests of athletes recently. And the editorial said something to the effect that, you know, like it or not, when you are an athlete for a major sport at a university like MSU, you are a public person.
And I absolutely concur with that. As a matter of fact, each year I meet with some of the teams. This year I spoke to the football team before the season started and the hockey team. I spoke to them about several issues. I, of course, wished them well during the season and hoped that they would succeed so that they could go on to a post-season experience, be that a tournament or a bowl game or whatever. But I told them that that wasn't their fundamental purpose for being at the university. It was to acquire an education. In fact, that very, very few of them would make it to the professional ranks, and even fewer would stay. And so they would require an education in order to succeed in life. But then I said also that they were an advantaged group of people, a privileged group of people, in that they received support for their education, financial, and more importantly, they achieved the notoriety, the recognition that comes with being an athlete. That notoriety and that recognition can lead to success later in life, even if one doesn't play professionally, because it's name recognition. Well, for that advantage that they gain, they have a responsibility to behave not just as well as others, but in an exemplary fashion. That goes for anyone who's in the public eye, including myself, I say to the players and the coaches. Therefore, you won't find us behaving publicly badly, because we recognize that we represent the institution and that we are recognizable people, and we will reflect badly on the institution if we do something that's inappropriate.
This is News Talk 870. This afternoon, we're talking with Michigan State University President John DiBiagio at 355-WKAR or 1-800-888-WKAR. You served on the Knight Foundation Commission, which was looking at reforming college athletics. What were the concerns? I mean, was there a final straw that led to the creation of the Knight Commission?
Well, I think everyone recognizes that the problems that we have in intercollegiate athletics are not new. People began to criticize intercollegiate sport back at the beginning of this century, and that's what precipitated the formation of the NCAA. The problems have been exacerbated in recent years, primarily because of the kinds of monies that are being derived from intercollegiate athletics. Now, there's a misconception that universities generate a great deal of support from intercollegiate athletics. That's not true. All the money we generate from sport goes back into the athletic department. In fact, a number of studies have shown that even contributions to institutions outside of contributions to athletics itself do not increase whatsoever during winning seasons. In fact, the best year's fundraising for the university in general that Notre Dame had were the Jerry Faust years. So in essence, we don't generate money for the university, but the enterprise keeps growing as it keeps generating more money, and they keep expanding their programs and the numbers of personnel they have, etc. And so the pressures to win have grown, not by the institutions, but by the enterprise itself, because people recognize winning brings in more dollars. A survey was done by Lou Harris, and that survey showed that the vast majority of the American people thought that there were real problems in intercollegiate athletics and problems that needed serious attention. So the Knight Foundation, which is very interested in funding higher education studies, put up $2 million initially and will expand that amount for a study of intercollegiate athletics, bringing together a group of people who they felt had the expertise, the background, and the interest to make some important suggestions. Some university presidents, some corporate people, some congressmen like Tom McMillan, who was an athlete himself, a representative of the boards of trustees of our universities, chairman of the board at Penn State, and the representative from the Association, National Association of Governing Boards. We started with the premise that we think intercollegiate athletics has an important role to play on our campuses for entertainment, for participation, for morale. And we want to see intercollegiate athletics prosper. We don't want to see it overtaken because of congressional legislation or whatever. And so, therefore, we started thinking that we had to find a way other than just the NCAA rules and regulations to achieve that objective. And our conclusion was that the issues of integrity, academic integrity and fiscal integrity, really belonged at the institutional level. We should be responsible for that. That is the leadership of those institutions. And that's what the report calls for. And with a caveat that there be a certification process whereby an objective group would come in annually and certify that you were following the very rules that you applied on your campus to all other students, for instance, in terms of admissions and normal progress and quality of life, the same rules that you apply in fiscal affairs to all other aspects of the campus. And if you were certified, you would play other schools that were certified. And those who chose not to be certified, or who couldn't be because they were violating their own rules, could go off and play one another, form, if you will, a bandit league. And the rest of us would follow the standards, and since we were all following comparable standards, we would all be on a so-called level playing field, and the games would be every bit as interesting.
People who are following the various stories at Michigan State University might note that recently there have been several athletes charged with drug-related activities. There is a coach facing charges of sexual assault, and that the university president and board of trustees were at odds over whether to concentrate in one person's hands head coaching and athletic directorship positions. Are those the kinds of concerns that led to the creation of the Knight Commission, or was the Knight Commission more focused on how much money is coming in and where that money's going?
I think the Knight Commission was more focused on assuring that the student athlete had a quality of life as much like other students as possible. I mean, that was the primary concern. These other issues are tangential to that, may contribute indirectly to that matter, but aren't necessarily directly related. And just as the instances you describe on this campus, they are quite distinct and separate from one another, quite different from one another. The fact that some students have been accused, and only accused, of drug trafficking, the fact that a coach is accused of another kind of a violation, the fact that there is a difference in opinion among some trustees with the administration on the structure of intercollegiate athletics, those are all separate and distinct issues and not necessarily related to one another. In fact, not related to one another, and have to be resolved through the normal mechanisms for coming to resolution in those kinds of issues. In one or two instances in the courts, in the other through the deliberations of the trustees themselves.
This is News Talk 870-355 WKAR, the telephone number here. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I know we stress a great deal to student-athletes and to students in general about not drinking and not using drugs and the importance of being good, per se. I was at a MSU football game last year, and I was out in front of the stadium, and I noticed all of these campers set up and a lot of tailgating parties and a great deal of alcohol, not only used but abused. And not only do I see this at Michigan State, but at Michigan and other universities. We say a lot of things to the students, but yet as professionals and supposedly adults, we do a lot of things that don't back up what we say. The gentlemen that were arrested this week in situations, the timing was kind of interesting, but they're just members of society just like anyone else. I mean, if the gentleman who was arrested with that large amount of cocaine was some Joe Blow from someplace else, it might have or might not have gotten in the newspaper, because there's a great deal of drug busts made on a daily basis in the city of Detroit that are never recorded in the paper and are never listed. And I just wonder how you feel about some of the signals that coaches and educators and professionals, not only at your university but in society, the messages that they give to a 20-year-old kid who could possibly be on his way to making $20 million a year. What kind of messages do they give to these kids to help them out?
Well, I think the caller makes my first point, of course, regarding the fact that it's unfair to focus so much attention on a student-athlete when indeed this does occur in society in general. Not that they shouldn't receive focus, but not to the degree that it does. It's just that athletics is such an important component, it seems, of our lives these days. I mean, the analogy that I use often is that when Harold Shapiro left the University of Michigan after a very distinguished career there as president, there was a modest front-page article in the Detroit papers and nice, modest editorials about his departure. I happen to respect Harold, and we're good friends, and I thought he was a wonderful president, and I thought he deserved that. When Bo left, however, there was an entire supplement to the paper, and there were days and days and days of analyses thereafter. And I'm afraid that athletes just have to face that reality. That's the kind of focus you get if you're in the enterprise, for whatever reason, and I can't really make determinations in that regard. I think the caller is correct. We do send mixed messages. There does seem to be a modicum of hypocrisy in the fact that we tell youngsters not to abuse substances, and then they see adults, their parents, abusing alcohol, and the message being sent that somehow or other alcohol is all right when other drugs are not. Well, quite frankly, the abuse of alcohol has been as destructive to our society as has the abuse of many other substances. And I think that it is a little disconcerting to me that I see the alcohol consumption, at least at the levels that it occurs, in tailgating, when we're trying to tell the kids that they're not supposed to be doing these things. You should know that we don't, of course, allow any alcohol in the stadium. And I have a box at the stadium, an enclosed box. We do not serve alcohol in that box at all. We only serve soft drinks and coffee.
If we can come back to some of the caller's other comments, he was saying that he thought the arrests, the timing was kind of interesting, if I'm remembering his words, although he didn't really elaborate on that. But if we look at the one problem of the series of drug-related arrests involving athletes, how would you say to somebody that that's not part of a pattern? I mean,
well, it's really hard for me. That would be speculative. You know, they just happen to be juxtaposition one against the other, and we just have to assume that that's coincidence, unless we have evidence to the contrary. And to this point, we have no evidence to the contrary. It just happened to occur concurrently. The one happened quite by serendipity, apparently, stopping someone for speeding, and not with the intent at all of looking for drugs. And in the other instance, of course, apparently, from what we know, and that's limited, it was a very well-planned arrest and after some investigation.
What is the university policy, and is that being followed in these cases regarding students who are facing criminal charges? In one case, federal criminal charges. These are people who are on athletic scholarships, but one is not being allowed to, as I understand it, go to Australia as part of a team trip.
Well, there are university policies, and there are policies that are policies specifically of departments or colleges. And in the case of athletics, they have policies, internal policies, which they can apply, such as suspending a student from a team for a period of time or prohibiting them from taking a trip or whatever. The university policies allow us to take administrative action if someone appears to be a clear and present danger to the community, someone who might be guilty of an assault or might be dispensing or selling drugs, not necessarily themselves utilizing those substances, someone who attempts to murder someone. We apply those only when we think the situation merits it, and when we do, quite frankly, carry under the Buckley Amendments, under the statutes, our federal statutes, we cannot release names of students against whom we take any action, nor the action taken. That can only come from the student themselves.
Is that part of what's behind the reassignment of Coach Parker?
Well,
I think, has taken over most of his duties at this point.
The decision to reassign was made by the athletic director in conjunction with the provost, to whom he responds, and that is not unusual, because that's action that's been taken in the past in similar circumstances, in order to allow the person to have a fair opportunity to clear their name, and yet at the same time not be in a situation where there would be any suggested threat to any other individuals.
This is News Talk 870, 45 degrees right now. This afternoon, cloudy. Rain is likely by late this afternoon. The high today in the lower 50s, and that chance of rain is 60% this afternoon, 90% this evening. Sports coming up at 1:15 with Jim Adams. He is previewing the Holyfield Foreman, or Foreman Holyfield, whichever you prefer, fight. He'll be talking with boxer Roger Turner and analyst Bob Every. We're talking this afternoon with MSU President John DiBiagio at 355-WKAR. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. First of all, I'd like to congratulate and thank the president for the stance that he's taking in reprioritizing our athletics versus academics on college campuses. Secondly, the issue I'd like to bring up is about our reward system for college coaches, for instance. I'm from the state of Alabama. I know that at the University of Alabama, which is has quite a football reputation, we pay our coach on the order of $500,000 a year. Now, I don't know what George Perlis makes, but I would imagine that George Perlis probably makes more than the president of the university, more than the governor, more than the president of the United States. So here we have a state employee who's, our state prioritizes as being more important than the President of the United States, and we have a system of kickbacks where the coach can go out and say, okay, I'll use exclusive Nike shoes, and he gets a kickback from the Nike company. Would an employee, for instance, of the State Department be able to say, I will use XYZ pencils only, and would he be able to get a kickback from the XYZ pencil company for his own personal use?
Well, the reality is that the coach or the coaches at this university, in terms of state salary, in terms of university salary, are not paid as much as many other people at the university. Coach Perlis makes, I think, and it's a public matter, something like $128,000, $129,000 in salary. However, the coaches do generate considerably more than that through agreements that are made with other agencies like shoe companies or through television shows that they sponsor. And that's one of the things the Knight Commission talked about, that really, quite frankly, that does seem to be a conflict of interest, that those monies should come back through the normal financial structure of the university. Now, that doesn't mean that some portion of those funds, substantial portion maybe even, would be returned to the individual. But it would be done in salary, and so it would be a more honest accounting process. And we really felt that that wasn't truly a problem. The analogy I like to use is, I can't imagine that we would permit one of our faculty members here, say a person who taught a science discipline, to bring in a particular kind of equipment into his or her laboratory so that the students would use that equipment and be inspired to purchase that equipment thereafter when they went into their own laboratories, and at the same time receive a kickback for using that particular equipment. We wouldn't stand for that for a moment.
Exactly.
And yet we've done that in intercollegiate athletics. Now, the argument that's made is that we have to have a level playing field. That is, if everyone else is doing it, we have to do it in order to be competitive. Well, my contention is you can level a playing field by lowering it to a common denominator, or you can level it by raising it. And if we were all to raise the level of the playing field by following real standards, by demanding the same expectations of our student-athletes that we have of all of our other students, since a playing field would now be level, even if at a higher level, it would be equally competitive.
Well, but how does a salary boost for a head coach from an athletic supply company for encouraging his athletes to use a certain brand of athletic supply or for himself to use or display that logo, how does that change the level of the playing field anyway? What difference does that make for the MSU football program if a certain coach wears Nike as opposed to Reebok?
The contention, it isn't the coaches, it's the players. And the contention is that since other schools are doing it, you will not be able to attract the best coaches unless you allow them to have the same advantages provided at another institution. I was in Florida, and someone said, gee, what will the Knight Commission do to our competitiveness, one of our alumni? I said, well, let me ask you this. Would it bother you? Would it be any less gratifying to you if we beat the University of Michigan in football, playing with all B-average students, and they're playing with all B-average students, rather than our playing with some students who are very much at the margin and them playing it with some students that are very much at the margin? Would it be any less gratifying? Do you think that the stadium here would be any less full when we played Michigan or Notre Dame or any other arch rival if everyone was a genuine student? And the person laughed and said, of course not. It would be equally as much fun for us and equally satisfying.
Does that help you out?
Yes.
Caller?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, there's a lot of resources in the greater Lansing area, whether it be the state government, LCC, the hospitals. What is the future of MSUN working with all these groups to make a better area to live in? And could you also talk about the Knight Commission report? And you were there at the meeting they had on WKR-TV. And what the Sports Illustrated reporter said, Rick Tellender. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Well, to answer your first question, I stated unequivocally in my last State of the University address that we had to form new partnerships, that we had to work much more closely with local organizations and groups, institutions, and with statewide organizations, groups, companies, whomever. And indeed, we are enhancing the linkages that we have with our local hospitals. We are working out a much different kind of relationship with Lansing Community College. We're going to develop a model there where students are going to be able to much more easily move from Lansing Community College to the Michigan State College, a university campus, and in fact may even be designated as Michigan State University students almost from the day they enter Lansing Community College if they maintain a certain grade point average. That model there then could be used with community colleges throughout the state. Abel Sykes is a superb president, we believe, of Lansing Community College and is very, very anxious to develop more and more collaborative programs, as are the hospitals. I became a member of the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce because we want to work not only with the large corporations in our community, but with small business alike. And I think you're going to find more and more of that kind of activity in the years that lie ahead. Now, to your other question, I was a bit taken by the comment made by the Sports Illustrated writer at the end of the show, as were all of my colleagues, because he had his facts seriously confused. And I was delighted that several of my colleagues who were on the show immediately pointed that out to him, and Bill Moyers was absolutely incensed at the comment and expressed that view then and after the show. The gentleman that we're discussing is very, very negative towards intercollegiate athletics in any dimension, and he's become terribly embittered, and I think that's unfortunate. Because while I would agree with him that we have problems and that those problems must be addressed, I don't think it's appropriate or right to say that we should eliminate the entire enterprise.
How would you respond to those who would say that the calls for reform of college athletics, which are really focusing on the bigger money sports like basketball and football, are racist?
Well,
Joel Ferguson, an MSU trustee, has said roughly as much when asked about the Knight Commission report.
Well, the only comment that I've seen from Trustee Ferguson was when the report first came out, and he admitted that he hadn't yet read it at the time. I think if one reads it carefully, they won't find that to be the case at all. In fact, what it does is it creates an environment which will more assure that all students have an opportunity for success, both while enrolled and after they graduate, and that they will graduate. It indeed says, in essence, that if they don't pass, that is, if they don't carry normal courses, required courses, and succeed in those courses, they cannot play. And I think that that encourages success rather than discourages performance of good quality. The real problem, Carrie, the problem that perhaps is not evident enough in the report and something that I felt very strongly about, is that we do not have farm clubs in football and in basketball. Because there are a number of youngsters who have a very special athletic talent. It's a genius, if you will. They do things that many of us are incapable of doing. And there's lots of kind of genius. There's intellectual genius. There is fine arts genius. And often, you know, fine arts students don't do very well on standardized tests, aren't very particularly, you know, skilled at mathematics and other such areas. And there is physical or athletic genius. And each has to be nurtured and developed. And an athlete should have the opportunity to develop that skill, unthwarted perhaps by some other activities. And if there were farm clubs, that opportunity would be there. I have talked to students on this very campus, athletes, who have told me quite frankly that they never wanted to be here, but there was no other option available to them. Because there were no farm clubs in these sports. We have people who come here and play baseball, who succeed as students, who want to be here as students, but who have that skill as well and end up playing Major League Baseball. We have those students in hockey. But those students do have the option, if they don't choose to come here, to go directly into a farm system and develop that special talent they have. And so I don't think it's discriminatory. I think what's going to do, it's going to compel those professional leagues, which just simply don't want to spend the money, to finally have to do what they should have done all along and develop the kind of programs to develop those athletes who want to play professional sport.
But why would they start feeling now as though they have to do that? I mean, they have facilities set up where students who may not want to go to that particular facility go because someone will pay their tuition or the university will pay their tuition so they can hone their athletic skills.
Exactly.
There's no pressure for the NFL
right,
or the NBA.
Can you imagine if the standards were the same standards that apply to all students, and those students who now are admitted who have little chance of succeeding were not given that chance, but who have athletic genius, then the professional leagues, if they want to maintain the level of competitiveness they now enjoy, will be compelled to establish farm clubs.
This is News Talk 87355 WKAR, the telephone number this afternoon, or 1-800-888-WKAR, to talk with MSU President John DiBiagio. In headlines at this hour, Secretary of State James Baker isn't talking about his meetings with Israeli officials in Jerusalem, but a spokesman for the Israeli Prime Minister says the talks were a deep discussion of advancing the peace process. News headlines coming up in another 20 minutes. News from the Associated Press at 1 o'clock. This is WKAR. Hi, thanks for holding.
Good afternoon. President DiBiagio, it's stated in writing the publications of MSU, both the student handbook and faculty handbook, the importance of academic freedom, the free and unfettered exchange of ideas. I have incontrovertible and legally admissible evidence that the personnel of this radio station are engaging in censorship by setting up a textbook example of prior restraint. This is illegal in violation of several laws, including felony violations of communication law and civil rights law. Ms. Bernstein, the wonderful young woman seated in front of you or in the studio, and her colleagues at WKAR AM have set up a textbook example of an unlawful and unlawfully asserted prior restraint.
Is there a question in here? Is there a question in here?
Please permit me to speak briefly.
You are violating a court order.
Censorship by prior restraint. It is your duty in that you are supervising them and in a position of a
Okay, we'll get some reaction from President DiBiagio.
Well, I really can't comment on that. As I understand it, this is a matter of litigation, and I think that those issues have to be handled through the appropriate mechanisms, and I certainly can't comment.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
Dr. DiBiagio, I'd like to have you speak on the importance of diversity in the student body and in the faculty to the total educational picture. What is being done to maintain or to increase that diversity in racial background, ethnic background, national origin, religious background? I ask this as a person who graduated in animal husbandry at Michigan State in 1950, got my graduate degree in economics, then became a Methodist minister after 4 more years at Yale. To me, relating with many people from many backgrounds is tremendously important, and I'd like to have you speak to your feeling about that.
Yes, well, I absolutely concur, and I've commented on this issue many, many times. In virtually every address that I make, we focus on diversity and the importance of diversity for two fundamental reasons, one of which is enormously pragmatic, and that is by the end of this century, a third of our population will be minority. And in fact, by the middle of the next century, what we now consider to be the minority will become the majority. Two-thirds of all employment in this decade of the 90s, will be women and minorities. And they will require education beyond high school in order to be employable. And so for very pragmatic reasons, for the survival of our state, for the prosperity of our nation, we have to diversify. And that is in our student body and in our graduating component. But there's a more fundamental reason. It's a moral reason. It's a reason that is part of the land-grant mission to which we all hopefully at this institution subscribe. And that is that we are to provide opportunity for all of our citizens, regardless of their socioeconomic status, to procure the highest possible education of which they are capable. In some instances, some have been denied that opportunity through no fault of their own, in some instances financial, in some instances because they are in school systems that are not able, even though they might desire to do so, to provide the kind of educational experience a student needs to be competitive in a university environment. We have to open our doors to those students, provide them at least the chance, provide them the enrichment that's required so they can be competitive. Now, in order to do that, in order to have an environment that is welcoming, that says to those individuals who are underserved, this university would love to have you here, they must see individuals on the campus with similar backgrounds, on the faculty, on the staff, throughout the entire university employment picture. We are trying to do that. We are actively recruiting faculty. We are actively asking others to consider when there is equality in the credentials of two individuals to appoint that person who comes from an underrepresented group. That's what affirmative action is really all about. Additionally, since there are many disciplines in which there are not faculty currently available, for whatever reason, perhaps they've been discouraged. Well, let's take women, for instance. For many, many years, women were discouraged from entering fields that were analytic, that required mathematics skills. In fact, I think that there are still people who say to women, you simply can't do math. Well, that's an outrage. So what we have to do is we have to provide graduate programs to prepare our faculty, if they're not available, so that we can diversify that faculty and the staff, again, so that we create an environment which is conducive to all people, thus thereby fulfilling our mission.
Can we talk about the debate over political correctness for a little while?
Sure.
That seems to be the topic of the month for a lot of columnists, and some authors have taken a look at it as well. Many people are concerned that out of a desire to make universities more accessible and more comfortable for ethnic and racial minorities, for handicappers, for gays and lesbians, there is a pressure to do the right thing say the right thing, which is silencing free speech. Some people have sort of compared it to a liberal McCarthyism, and say that it could really eat away at the value of an education if you're focusing on first-rate white male authors like Shakespeare, but you need to include females and minorities, and there aren't enough female Shakespeares or minority Voltaires, and you go to the second rank or second caliber authors, you're defeating the purpose of going to college.
Yeah, well, there's a great deal of polarization on this issue, as you know. The one extreme says that you must not allow any comments to be made, positions to be taken that might be offensive to any group. The other says, in essence, that you must allow all expression, no matter how derogatory, no matter how painful, and that you haven't, in an environment of academic freedom, you cannot prohibit that. Well, both positions, in my view, are wrong. The fact is that we certainly, in a university, we absolutely believe it's one of our cardinal principles in academic freedom. People must be allowed to express themselves openly and freely. And I think most people on this campus would agree with that position. On the other hand, when someone does something that is clearly offensive, while I don't think necessarily that we should take action against someone for having done so, I think we have a responsibility to say that we disagree, to express the view that that is contrary to what most people feel about that particular issue. I sometimes find those who are arguing the issue of political correctness and saying that whenever we condemn or criticize someone for an inappropriate behavior or remark, we are doing nothing but intruding in every instance on that individual's academic freedom. I think in some of those instances, those people are just finding or trying to find a way to validate their own discriminatory attitudes and prejudicial attitudes towards a group. And it's a convenient way of doing that by saying, well, affirmative action is all wrong, you see. And one should, if you really believe in equal opportunity, everyone should have equal access regardless, and it should be absolutely competitive by some standard measure. Well, I disagree with that position, and I'm not reluctant to say so. But the reality is, for some, they can attack that on very, you know, analytic grounds. But I think it's just a way of masking their true deep down negative attitudes towards a group.
There was a student at an Ivy League university who had supposedly spent part of an evening shouting various epithets outside a quadrant of student housing, and this was not the first time the student had supposedly done this. The student was either suspended or expelled, not because of his speech, but because of his actions. Well, but his actions were speech.
But in that case, he was disturbing the peace, if you will, because there were students there who were trying to conduct their affairs, perhaps trying to study, and this is an intrusion on their privacy as well. And I don't think one has the right to do that. You know, it's the old case of shouting fire in the middle of a theater, and one can't do that. On the other hand, if someone in a civil way wants to take exception to a position taken by the institution or the position taken by a group within the institution, they have every right to do that, and we have to protect that right in the right environment under the right circumstances.
How would you respond to those who would say that efforts to diversify what has traditionally been a Western white male curriculum are undermining the value of that education by looking to second or third or fourth rank women or minority authors, so that you're not spending all of your time focusing on dead white European males.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the quality of any endeavor, like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder, right? And when someone says someone is third, fourth, fifth quality, I wonder what the standard is for quality. I mean, you know, the one thing about art is that it changes. Not only art itself, but the interpretation of art, of humanities. And one reads various things differently in one aspect, one time in one's life versus another, and comes to different conclusions from those readings. Some authors who are highly regarded during their own time, some painters who are highly regarded during their own, sculptors, are not thought of so highly years later. And some who are seen as being relatively unimportant during that period are highly admired and appreciated. I am very fond of impressionistic art. One only has to read the history of impressionistic art, the fact that Van Gogh could never sell a painting, and one sees now the value of those paintings in society and the way we admire them, to appreciate that analogy. So quite frankly, while I think we should teach the classics, absolutely, I am appalled at how little our people read. I am disappointed at how many of our students haven't read certain works that were fundamentally a part of our growing up and we were anticipated to read when I was a student in high school. And those are a very important part of their own, of Western culture and civilization. I equally believe that we have not focused adequately on the contributions of people from other cultures. I think we can do both. We can weave into what we are currently doing in our history, for instance, the contributions of many, many cultures to our successes. And in our literature, the greatness of the writings of many from very different cultures, not just our own American cultures, of course, which are very diverse and varied, but also from other parts of the world other than just the West.
This is News Talk 870 this afternoon, a 60% chance.